carrefour des arts. Une émission de la rédaction de Canal Académie. On retrouve Christa Leuc.
William Blake, visionary genius of English Romanticism. William Blake for the first time in Paris. This is a real event. It is the first retrospective in France since a tribute which the British Council, together with the Galerie René Drouin, organized right after the liberation in 1947, that was more than 60 years ago. Mrs. Catherine de Bourgoin, assistant director of the Musée de la Vie Romantique, who was also in charge of the very fine and richly documented catalogue of the exhibition, our listeners will find all the references on our webpage. Mrs. de Bourgoin, hello.
Hello.
And thank you so much to spend your precious time for Canal Académie and guide us through this so exceptional William Blake retrospective. As there is such a huge number of works to be seen and to comment on, please let me suggest for this visit to proceed by the main periods of William Blake's life, starting at his first years of awakening until his old days. But first of all, let me ask you, who is William Blake? A poet, a painter, an engraver, an esoteric, a mystic, Catherine de Bourgoin?
He's everything at the same time. William Blake is one of the greatest English-speaking poets, as great as Shakespeare, and we all know him when we read English. Everybody has learned at least a poem when he was a child, which would be Tiger, Tiger. And his hymn, like Jerusalem, is sung in stadiums, political meetings, since the last war of 1914. So we are very happy to welcome this beautiful work, which has never really been shown in Paris since this exhibition you mentioned, and it was a small show. This show in the Petit Palais is showing about around 150 works, coming mainly from Britain. Museum of Fitzwilliam in Cambridge is the great lender, and the second lender in quantity is the Glasgow Library. And we have major works from the Tate in London, the Victoria and Albert, the British Museum, the British Library, famous Bodleian Library, Birmingham Art Museum, and the Tomb Museum of Manchester. We also have a beautiful print, Newton from Philadelphia in America, and two works from Toronto. And the only work that is in France, from the Louvre, a watercolor that has been recently bought in 2006. So we are very happy to show this work, which hasn't been known at all by the French, either as art or as poet. William Blake was discovered in France in around 1900. It was first translated by some scholars. And then in the 20s, it was translated by Gide. And it is the surrealist who discovered his art, his paintings. And then it was only in the 40s that his poems were put together in an anthology of poems in France. So it's quite recent, this discovery. And this is why this show is so important. So, and it has been beautifully conceived by Michael Phillips from Scotland, who tried to show the major steps of William's work. The first step is his childhood. We are happy enough to show three drawings from the Fitzwilliam drawn in Westminster Abbey when William Blake was an apprentice. He was the son of a hosier, a Londoner from London, and he was sent to a drawing school when he was a child, showing early talent. And his father, when he came out of his drawing school, thought it would be a great idea to send him to an engraver as an apprentice. That's what he could afford. He couldn't afford a painting apprenticeship. And he sent him to a very quite known engraver of the time, James Bazire, who was working for the Society of Antiquaries. So William Blake, for 7 years, could learn all the skills of a real copy engraver. and this skill never left him. Beside his personal work, he was always a copy engraver, working for publishers, for books, and for prints that you could buy as a collector. And this enabled him to live, because his own work that we're going to talk about was very seldom bought by just a few patrons and couldn't make a living. So William Blake was sent to this apprenticeship, and he drew these medieval tombs in Westminster Abbey as a first order to his master. This step of his life is very important, because that's how he discovered Gothic art. And we must be aware, and there's a text written by Martin Myron from the Tate in the catalogue, that we are at the beginning of the Gothic revival, which is very early, earlier than in France. And William Blake is very aware, like a lot of scholars of the time, a lot of artists, that there are some novels written, poems written in the Gothic manner, and he's very interested in Gothic art, and he is among people who state that Gothic art is the first British art, which is very important at the time. So Gothic art, being the first British art, is still in his mind when later he will publish his poems in books that he will make himself as illuminated books, and he will think of medieval books, of course. So the second step of the exhibition shows another side of William Blake, who is a talented child, talented young man, learning engraving with all the skills of a very good engraver, but also a man who has visions. He writes poems since his early age, since he's probably 10 or 12, and he declares that he has visions. In French, we would say hallucination, which means that he dreams of people, of angels. They're very often religious visions. He mentions a vision, a very important vision, in Westminster Abbey, which is angels floating or something like that. And another time he mentions Ezekiel
under the tree.
Under a tree. They're very often religious, and they inspire his writings. So the young man, young engraver, has visions, writes poems, and starts being a professional when he comes out of his apprenticeship. His first year, when he's a professional, he doesn't immediately start on his own. He goes to the Royal Academy for 1 year, and he's trained there by a chiseler, a Swiss man who has learned to be a chiseler, and he is trained to learn anatomy, like any student who was in the academy, and history painting. And it's very important for him, because he will always remember this training, and he will always want to exhibit at the Royal Academy, which he will do 6 times in his life. And we have beautiful neoclassic watercolor dated 1785, showing this history, a biblical subject that he has shown at the Royal Academy. The third step of his life is that he decides that he's going to publish his poems, illustrated by himself, without using typography, and make his own books by hand, sewn by hand by his wife, and he will sell them cheaply, bringing, as he says, beautiful art, exquisite art, to humble homes, selling them very cheaply. He has married, when he's young, when he left school, he has married a young woman who is the daughter of a gardener, completely illiterate, who becomes a very helpful wife, and he teaches her to write, to read, and to draw, and she will assist him all his life and be his constant companion in some kind of solitude. Blake decides that he's going to print his own books, And he's has a helper who is his brother. He has a sister and four brothers, and his favorite brother, Robert, has been for 2 years his helper when he decides that he will print his own books and watercolor them and sell them cheaply. His young brother dies, sadly, and Blake has a vision of his young brother dictating him a new way of doing this scheme. He decides that it will be relief etching. And the relief etching consists of writing and drawing on copper with a varnish that resists to acid, and then putting the acid that will bite everything except the text and the drawings that will remain in relief. This technique is very simplified when I describe it, but it's very much more difficult and time-consuming than one would say. And it's very difficult really to summarize, and there's been a lot of discussion about it, and there's a book about it that has been published by the Tate. So each book of his poems is illustrated by hand, which means on a press, and monochrome printed, and then it's watercolored by hand, and then it's sewn, each book is sewn, and then sold to a patron who is interested. The first books that are really his famous, most famous books are the Songs of Innocence. The Songs of Innocence are poems that were written for children. They are rather like musical poems that he would sing to his friends. And each song is illustrated. And the most famous song is Tiger, Tiger, that everybody knows when one speaks English, everyone has learned at school.
And maybe we can listen to it, if you would be so kind and read it to us.
Tiger, Tiger is a very interesting poem because it shows how Blake was interested in the politics, and I will explain later. Tiger, Tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? What the hammer, what the chain, in what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dead grasp, dare its deadly terrors clasp? So these two little bits of the poem are very interesting because the tiger is a symbol of French Revolution at the time in the Britannica Encyclopedia. And William Blake, like his friends, like his publisher he works for when he does printing, copy engraving, is very interested in the French Revolution and all the ideas of the French Revolution. And he lives at the time when the king, George III, it's at hard times because in 1793, when he writes this poem, it's time in France when there are lots of slaughters in Paris and a lot of blood is shed. And the king's blood also, the king is decapitated. And when the British king hears this drama, he decides to have a new law punishing anyone who writes against the royalty. And so Blake, being very anti-royal, being very Republican, feels in danger because when you work for a publisher, you are capable of writing pamphlets. So this shows how brave Blake is when he writes allusions in his poems. When he writes, what the hammer, what the chain, he is writing about prison. What furnace was thy brain? What the anvil? He means forged iron. He means chains. So it's very interesting to read the poems and see and hear the double meanings in his poems and in his books. The major books we have in the exhibition, one of them is America, a Prophecy. And it's very interesting to look at the pictures and see the monochrome frontispiece and then how he paints it with watercolor, and the frontispiece becomes absolutely beautiful with a man with his wings and his face hidden in his knee, a man stooping down with chain hands and wings and his face hidden in his hair. And this man is supposed to be the revolution of America, and he will in the next page bounce in the flames, and it will be the cosmic energy bringing us to a new world that Blake is dreaming of. a world of universal religion, a world far from all the terrors of wars and plague and the negative things that we know since the fall of Adam.
And also against slavery.
Yes, Blake is very aware of all the poverty around him, the slavery in America, the condition of women around him. He's a very modern man in a way. He's very radical, as they say, in England. He is against a religion which is directed by a king. He is looking for a universal religion of love. And he is dreaming of a world where people would be equal. There would be no slavery. There would be sexual liberation. A new age, in a kind. This is why Blake was so appealing in the 60s and 70s to people who knew his art, I mean in the 20th century. So the second book we're showing is Europe, A Prophecy, which is a sort of pendant of America, A Prophecy. And on the cover, we show this strange god holding his compasses, and it's a satyr of the king of George III, who brings all these wars that Blake refuses to admit. We must remember that Blake lives at a time of wars. When he is born, it's the wars of the Seven-Year Wars, which last 7 years, and it's against France and Spain. And then there's a war of independence of America, and then there's a coalition wars against France again and against Napoleon. So England is constantly in wars, and this is constantly also on Blake's mind. Another step in the exhibition shows the great large color prints. So Blake did quite a few books. We call them illuminated prophetic books because he wanted to imitate medieval books, blending his text with his illustration, and that's what he did. And he did quite a few, the Book of Tell, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, The Visions of Daughter of Albion, and then America and Prophecy and Europe a Prophecy. And all these books are shown here in some cases. He tried to sell them in 1793, on the year he produced Europe a Prophecy and America a Prophecy, and it was a complete failure because he was no good at selling, and he didn't know many people, and it's only a few friends who were artists who came and bought a few of his books. So after this great disappointment, he started something new. He went to large color prints, and that's another part of the exhibition, showing beautiful, bigger sized prints. We show Newton coming from Philadelphia, Hecate coming from the Tate, and the Pitti coming from the Tate.
Very emblematic water prints.
They are big, they're large sized. The technique is very different. It's like a monotype, rather like Degas' technique, complicated technique that enabled him to do two or three prints of the same work only. And he did altogether 12 large color prints, and we're showing three. They are very rare nowadays. The one of the most famous that we're not showing has been shown very often is Nabucodonosor, the man kneeling on his hands and long hair and long beard. And these beautiful prints, one of them is inspired by Shakespeare, the Pitti, showing this woman with a mysterious surrealist hairdo and flying on in the sky on a horse, showing a holding a baby above a floating figure like an Ophelia. This beautiful print probably and very surely influenced the Pre-Raphaelite. And we must mention Don Gabriele Rossetti, who was a great admirer of Blake and who bought some of his works and some of his writings. And his brother William was Blake's first historian, and he even printed some of his texts. So the surrealists in the 20th century discovered this kind of these prints, and they were very attracted to them, especially the pity that we're showing in the exhibition.
There's another work of Blake I would like you to describe, because it's a very big event for France. It's the first work of Blake which was bought by the Friends of the Louvre, and is, I think,
The Death of the Strong Man.
The Death of the Strong Man. Can you just please tell us how come that it came to the French collection, to the Louvre?
Oh, it's very interesting. It's an illustration to Robert Blair's poem, The Grave. And this set of illustration was commissioned to Blake and was to be engraved by him. But then the publisher, who was called Cromock, decided that it wouldn't be Blake to print the watercolors. It would be somebody else called Schiavonetti, who was an Italian artist. And he didn't tell Blake, he just not told, and he found out one day that he wasn't commissioned the engravings, and he was furious. And then in 2001, librarian of a man owning a bookshop in Glasgow found a red leather case with around 20 watercolors on their actual original mount, signed by Blake and illustrating these poems. So one doesn't know if it was a set that had been sold by Blake or sold by the publisher or lost. One doesn't really know the story, but it's obvious that they are, you know, true originals.
By Blake.
Yes. And they were sold, the man who found them sold them at Sotheby's. It was very lucky because the Louvre was able to buy one of the most beautiful. And this is how now a public collection in France owns a watercolor by Blake, which wasn't the case before. Because the few works, the rare works by Blake, were bought at the time by his patrons. And when his patrons died, their possessions were sold at auctions and bought by British museums. The British Museum, actually, and the British Library also, who are lenders to this exhibition, bought some, the Victorian Albert, the Tate, the Fitzwilliam. And this is how Blake's works is exclusively in England and very much also in America, but mainly in England. And there's never any works by him on the market. So that was a very lucky story.
Absolutely, yes. And thanks to the Amis du Louvre.
Thanks to the Amis du Louvre, yes.
Was their president, Marc Maroli of the Académie Française. France now owns the first Blake.
Which was a very big buy at the time because Blake's works fetch a very, very high price.
So we come now to the
watercolors.
To the watercolors, yes.
We come to the last part of the exhibition, shows that Blake did an exhibition of his works. He tried to sell his works at his brother once in 1793, and it was a complete failure. And he tried to show his works, mainly temperas then, at his brother's shop. His brother was a hosier like his father in 1808. And it was also a failure. So poor Blake, when he tried to show his work outside his circle of friends, it was always a failure. And he was showing it at 16 temperas. Among them, one of them was a Canterbury Tale by Chaucer. And for him, it was very important. He made a catalogue and everything, and it was a failure. So we show a print of this picture. We show the catalogue, and we show how important it was for him. And we show a series of biblical watercolours that he did for a few patrons. His main patron for 20 years was Thomas Bach, who commissioned a lot of biblical subjects in watercolour and in tempera and in prints. And Blake did hundreds of them for him. And then he had some other commissions through other people. And his main patron at the end of his life was a young artist called John Linnell, who was 26, very young, who could have been his son, and who commissioned him and helped him a lot because Blake was very poor. And even 2 years before his death in 1827, he was had a grant by the Royal Academy because of £25, because, as they wrote, he was in great distress. So Blake was never rich, and he worked till the end. He worked, his last works were a series of watercolors ordered by Linnell on the Divine Comedy by Dante. And he managed to do more than 100 watercolors and 7 engravings on the subject. And they are the most beautiful works that his watercolors are so free, freer than the previous ones, and they're absolutely beautiful. And we have about 6 from the Birmingham Museum of Art. And it's a great honor to have
there's
this.
There's one in particular of the hell, which is absolutely stunning.
Yes, the Circle of the Lustful.
Yes.
A very famous watercolor about Francesco da Rimini and Paolo, her brother-in-law, in a sort of big
wave
of a hell that doesn't really look like hell.
Yes. It's and, rather promising, yes.
Yes. And there's also a series of a poem by Milton that he illustrated, a very beautiful series of 6 watercolors that we are showing. And we end the exhibition with a print by Bacon. And it's very interesting for the French to know that Bacon was a fan of William Blake. And he had he was fascinated by the artist. And he had painted the mask that we are showing, the life mask, the plaster life mask that was done when Blake was alive on his face. By a sculptor who was very interested in Blake's face and thought that he had the forehead of a great imagination. And he asked him permission to do a mask of his face because he thought it was such an interesting face. So we are showing this famous plaster mask, and Bacon was fascinated by it. He bought a copy of it, had it in his bedroom, and he did 3 oil paintings of that mask. And this is how we end the exhibition, with a print of that and a picture by Jean Cortot, who is an elderly French painter, academician, who was always interested in Blake and who did, in the 80s, did a few paintings, we're showing 4, in homage to Blake.
And how about the man, William Blake? He was plenty of contradictions. He had the reputation of being some sort of madman.
He had the reputation of being a madman because he had these visions. Since he was 10, 12, he had these visions. He was convinced that they were real. He was convinced that he was a reincarnation of Milton, that Milton took his hand when he was a child and showed him the way to poetry. He was interested in these republican ideas. He would even apparently walk in the street with a red bonnet of a French revolutionary. He was solitary. He was completely convinced with his ideas. He was probably stubborn, probably difficult to deal with, very independent. He didn't care about material things. He lived very poorly. He thought he was a great artist, and as long as he could sell some of his art to some of his friends, some of his artist friends, he was happy, and it was enough for him. He managed to show his art 6 times at the Royal Academy, and he thought it was all right. He didn't mind if he didn't have more than 6 visitors at his exhibition. He didn't mind. All he wanted was to do his art. He worked a lot. He worked till the last day. He had no children. He had a faithful wife who helped him, who respected his work, who sold it very cleverly when he was dead. And he was very lucky to have her, and he was convinced he was a great artist and he didn't want more in life.
As I wandered the forest, the green leaves among, I heard a wild flower singing a song. I slept in the earth in the silent night. I murmured my fears and I felt delight. In the morning I went, as rosy as morn, to seek for new joy, but I met with scorn.
And at what time, actually, did he really become famous?
He became, I would say, not famous, but well-known when his biography was printed in 1865 by a man called Gilchrist, who had met him, but then who had died, and who had... biography was finished by his wife, who was helped by some people who had known Blake. So that book is very, very precious to people who know him, for people who want to know about Blake. And so that made him more well-known, but he was more famous when the museums managed to buy his work around the same time, and then he was appreciated by the British, but the French only discovered him in the 20th century.
Because he's not very well known in France, I must say.
He's not studied by a lot by art historians. There are a few people I met who had courses at the École du Louvre. A few teachers sometimes give courses on him. And of course, it's more the French University on British Literature who know. They teach a lot about Blake's poetry. We have held, for the exhibition, we had the help of Université Diderot in Paris, and Yves Bonnefoy also, who is a great scholar here, very respected, you know, talks a lot about Blake. And there are quite a few university teachers who, quite a number, but they are Anglicists, and they teach more about literature than it is taught in
art history. Or engravings. Mm-hmm.
But still.
Well, the only French artist I can think about who would have some similarities would be Gustave Moreau.
Yes.
Quite some years later. But otherwise, William Blake's art is sort of the opposite of the French Impressionists. So the French culture is really very much influenced by this sort of playings of the light, which is very typical for the French Impressionists. And William Blake is very different.
And William Blake's world is an imaginative world. It's a world of the mind and imagination, and so it's very,
but not
very
intellectual. Even though he was quite a cultivated man.
Yes, he was not a primitive man. He was very well read. He would, since his young days, he had read, of course, the Bible throughout. He had read the Koran. He had read. He was interested in all religion. He read the Catholic mystics. He read the alchemists. He was interested in ideas like Swedenborg, like Paracels. And then he read, of course, Dante. He even pretended that he had learned Italian in a few weeks to read Dante in the text. And then he pretended he had learned French in a few weeks' time to read Voltaire. But he read, even if he didn't, he read what people would read at the time, people who were scholars, who were people who were well-read. He was a man of curiosity. He was like a lot of people of the time. It was a difficult time where they saw revolutions nearby, opposite the channel, a king being put to death. That some people thought it would be the end of the world, and there were lots of questions, and especially religious questions. And
he belonged to that. He was a spiritual man.
He belonged to that generation. And who was rejecting a very formal religion headed by a king. And all these ideas were mingling in his mind. And
he was sort of a son of the Enlightenment, one could say, no?
So I think he never stopped. He was either reading or working.
With an immense
He had no children that gave him time. And he was working day and night, probably.
Yeah. In front of an immense production, you can only guess by coming to this exhibition, because there are a couple of rooms, but it's a very important retrospective. And thanks to you, Catherine de Bourgoin, not only French visitors of Petit Palais Museum of Fine Art, but also the whole world can now become more familiar with William Blake's art, because for an internet radio, the whole world can listen to you. So thank you so much for the whole world.
Thank you. But there's a Blake archive one can connect to in America. So you do just Blake archive, and it's very well done.
Yes,
and
but you
it's
have to
updated by
be invited.
Great scholars.
Yes, but you have to get the impulse and to be invited. And this exhibition and retrospective is really a fabulous opportunity to get into this mystical, enigmatic world of William Blake. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I prepared your canoe with cedar boughs. It's time for you to leave now, William Blake. Time for you to go back to where you came from.
You mean Cleveland?
Back to the place where all the spirits came from. And where all the spirits return. This world will no longer concern you.